This week on the show, LimeWire goes south, radio is under attack again, Brits pay for the news, and it turns out the cord cutters aren't broke, they're just tired of TV. Right here on This Week in Media, number 208. Hey everyone, welcome back to This Week in Media. This is Alex, and we are here with, of course, our usual suspect, Tim Street, who is coming in from Streaming Media West.
Streaming Media West, yeah, taking place in Los Angeles this time. I'm at the Century Plaza Hotel with a beautiful view of the ocean.
Very nice.
Lots of exciting stuff going on. I'm anxious to get downstairs and hear what all the new announcements are in the world of streaming video.
Evidently, this is all the rage.
It is, and MDialogue, the company that I work for, we have a big announcement today about live video and a live video control panel that you can use to dynamically insert ads into your live feed. So that's kind of on the QT right now. But by the time this podcast goes out, we'll be in good shape.
Hey, now how does someone like me get to use that?
You talk to me, Alex.
Okay, I'm going to talk to you about that because I need that. So we'll talk about that offline. Also here, Dane Golden. Dane, of course, from Twit fame, and also a producer for quite some time for Twim and some of our other shows. Hey, Dane, how's it going?
Right. Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's great to have you. We're pulling Dane into the mix here today, and we've got a lot to talk about, so I'm just going to dive in. Now, Dane, what are you working on right now?
I'm at Hey.com, my own website. I'm doing a lot of interesting interviews from people around the world and around the web.
Yeah, fantastic. All right, so coming up here, LimeWire has finally hit the ground. I don't think any of us were really that surprised by the whole thing, but this is they finally have a quote-unquote permanent injunction. Sometimes you get the temporary injunction. When you get the permanent one, it means you're going to have to turn off and we're going to take away the switch. So they've taken away the switch. The courts have, and they have said that LimeWire has done irreparable harm to the music industry. It has single-handedly crushed any future for new Britney Spears. Now, I don't know if it has or not. Now, Tim, do you think that this has really any impact at this point?
Well, I think there's a lot of people that are going to be very upset that they can no longer get free music and videos off LimeWire. So I think it's going to affect them. It's interesting that it took this long. You know, you look at Napster, and while the whole Napster thing was going on, I was like, well, what about LimeWire? What about LimeWire? And for some reason, I think LimeWire just flew under the radar. And maybe that was in part because it worked on the Mac, and it was like Mac users used it a lot. I don't know about how much the PC world used it back then.
Well, I think it seems like their legal team stretched it out for quite some time, too. So maybe they had a better set of lawyers as far
there,
as
there you go.
Out. Well, I mean, because I know that I think a lot of people just kind of shrugged when Napster went under and said, well, there's LimeWire. I mean, there was Grokster and LimeWire and all these other ones that were still around. Dane, do you think this is going to make any real impact on the general direction of the music industry?
Well, I think a couple of things. First of all, it was Judge Kimball Wood, which I can't ever say without remembering that she was almost Attorney General under Clinton. But I was reading on Torrent Freak that MP3 Rocket and BearShare dramatically shot up in their downloads when LimeWire was shut down. So MP3 Rocket's going to rebrand themselves, though they are being affected by this, and so they're going to be a YouTube video to MP3 downloading client in the coming weeks.
Interesting. Yeah, but, so this is more of a whack-a-mole kind of thing.
In a way it is, but I think that, in fact, in my opinion, I think much as the whole concept of physical media is essentially obsolete, I think that what we're going to see more is streaming media, Spotify and stuff like that, whereas the actual having the files is not going to be as important.
I can see that. Now, speaking of Spotify, this is actually our next story. We have Apple and Google are quote-unquote in plays to acquire the music streamer. This is according to Appalicious. So there's a lot of rumors that are starting to swirl around. Of course, Reuters has said no, there's nothing happening. Spotify has said no. Apple has declined to comment as usual. But the rumor mill keeps on turning that Apple may be interested in purchasing Spotify and possibly Google. I think anything that Apple's interested in buying, Google's interested in buying, and vice versa. Tim, what can you tell our listeners, what does Spotify do? Or Dane, actually, you were just talking about it. So what does Spotify do?
It's a streaming subscription service that's popular in Europe and has not come to the U.S. yet. I, for one, believe Apple will not be buying it because these contracts, these grandfathering in contracts that people make with that labels make with Spotify, means that if anyone acquires them, the deal ends. So right. I think that this will not be purchased by Apple, but the best, most important purchase a company like Google or Facebook or Twitter or for Microsoft for that matter could ever make.
Interesting.
Because that brings people into your environment and gives you an iTunes right off the bat.
Tim, do you think that Spotify could make it in the United States? Do you think the record labels would ever make that deal?
Well, you know, I think that this would be great for Europe. But in terms of the U.S., I'm kind of wondering. You know, the value is when you have a whole big user base to acquire that user base and then get them hooked on your crack as well. And you know, that's where the value would be. So people, to mine, I don't know anyone that uses Spotify. I mean, there might be people I know. I just don't. Nobody talks about it in my circle of friends. So I don't know if it would be that valuable in the U.S.
Interesting. Now speaking of finding an audience and selling them crack, I don't know how that got connected to this, but a British news site, so News Corp. Now, News Corp, one thing that they've been really talking about over and over and over again is they want to create paywalls. They want to find a way to provide content and get paid for it as they work. And so and now they say that more than 100,000 people are paying for their site. So this is this is according to the New York Times, and so this is for the digital versions of the Times and the Sunday Times of London, and they said that since that they started providing this access to their websites in June, the company said around half of these were regular active subscribers to the newspaper's websites, iPad application, or Amazon Kindle edition. The rest are occasional purchasers. Another 100,000 readers have activated free digital accounts that are included in the print subscriptions to the paper, the News Corp said. So it looks like now, and these aren't the only folks. I mean, The Economist, Wall Street Journal, some more vertical markets have been effective at being able to create this kind of paywall for information. But this is a much more wide audience that they're kind of shooting for. Tim, do you think that this has a future? Do you think that they're going down the right path?
Well, I think it really depends on when consumers see a value there. As long as the information that you want and that is relevant to you that you can get to for free, why would you pay for it someplace else unless there was some added value? You know, your son wrote the article, or, that there was some reporter, journalist that you really enjoyed the way that they wrote stuff, and you couldn't get that specific piece of news someplace else. I mean, when you look at the Wall Street Journal, there's information there that's really valuable to people in the business world, and they want that analytical information, and they're willing to pay for it so they can put it behind a paywall.
Well, yeah, and I think the biggest paywall that I know of is Bloomberg. I mean, you know, these guys are paying. You've got 200,000 people paying, or you know, I don't know, paying crazy amounts of money. So so Bloomberg is a great example of, they have a very vertical market. They have people who really need all that information. They need it in real time. They need it to happen, and they are able to do that as a result of their of the kind of content they provide. Now, this is a much more wide audience. Dane, what do you think you need to provide so that people are willing to pay?
You're saying what type of content?
What kind of content, and how do you have to provide the content in a way that has people think, oh, I actually want to buy that?
Well, I think first of all, you can't start by having it be free. I think there are ways of having a freemium model, but if people get the entire content for free from the start of the service. It's very difficult to put it behind a paywall. News Corp, half of their the numbers that they're quoting here of the 105,000 are for their iPad and Kindle sales, but it's promising early on. I don't know that I have that formula of how you create that paywall. I don't know. I don't have an answer for you there.
I know that, I mean, I definitely still buy, when I think about when I buy magazines, I feel like I'm still buying that. But I guess I'm buying, in some ways, convenience. You know, when you're buying a Wired magazine or Economist, those are probably the two most common ones.
You're saying in print?
Well, I'm buying them in print, although as they become more available digitally, I find myself mm-hmm. not willing to buy the paper version.
I think with magazines, there certainly is that, there still is that tactile, glossy feel that people do enjoy, but with the iPad, I think that that is tempering that.
You know, the only the only reason that the magazines are only useful to me because they're easier to read in the bathroom and on the first 10 minutes and last 10 minutes of a flight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the only need I have for paper. You know, because the outside of that, I like to put everything on my iPad. It's mostly a matter of transport. You know, I don't want to deal with you know, that process. I mean, that's the issue. Is I don't want to carry all that stuff around. I spend a lot of time moving from place to place, and so you know, a book. I find that even now with books, the first thing I do, it's not for price or anything else, but the first thing I do is look for either an iBook or a Kindle version, and I'm actually have a lot of Kindle stuff just because now I have this library of books on my iPad that I can, you know, get to more effectively. So
if I can't bookmark it anymore for use later, I really am not using print. I haven't really bought a newspaper, I think, in a year, but I read the newspaper every single day.
Right.
I'm a big iPhone user, so.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, so jumping to the next story here, this is from the papers in New Zealand. Now, this has been we talked about this a couple weeks ago, and it kind of it built to a crescendo. And this is dealing with the union rules in New Zealand. And a lot of this all got built up around The Hobbit. So, of course, it's amazing that one little dude can create so much upset. But as essentially, there's this massive production. The budget now is reported, according to TVNZ, as TVNZ.co.nz, $670 million production is going, you know, is how much the Hobbit budget is for the two movies that they're going to split into the Hobbit. So there's they know they're going to get the money back. I mean, the Lord of the Rings have been successful. Peter Jackson's working on it, and there has been this big push by Australian unions to unionize New Zealand. Now, on one side, you know, they say that, you know, the Australian unions, of course, are saying that the workers are being taken advantage of. They're not able to organize. They're not able to do, you know, to push that forward. On the other side, what you really have is a mixture of two things. One is that New Zealanders are afraid that the Australian union is simply trying to unionize them to even the playing field and take the work back to Australia. They're not really that interested in helping New Zealand. And as a Pittsburgher, I kind of see that point.
Pittsburgh had a huge film growth for a while.
We had the largest film growth for a while, and we unionized. The New York unions unionized us, and then it was gone. And it was really because once the playing field was evened out again, all the work went back to New York. And so there's a concern that there's going to be a mirror of something like that in New Zealand. Also, there's just a concern that there's a lot of runaway productions. New Zealand itself is a runaway production where things are going to it. But if it makes it more, if it becomes more difficult to shoot there, there's a lot of, you know, you could shoot The Hobbit just as easily, although it would be less familiar. You could shoot The Hobbit just as easily in, you know, Eastern Europe or other places. And so the real issue has been this push back and forth. How it ended essentially is that the government ended up providing a pretty good deal, a $20 million tax break to Warner Brothers to keep the movie in New Zealand. And then they also clarified some of the rules. So it turns out that most people in film production in New Zealand are independent contractors. They're listed as mm-hmm. independent contractors, even long term. And so what they did is they simply clarified that and codified that. It was just kind of one of those things that had been kind of happening. Most of the people that I know that work at Weta are all independent contractors. And the downside.
Could you explain Weta, please?
Oh, sorry. Weta is the visual effects firm that pretty much did all the stuff on The Lord of the Rings, a lot of stuff on Avatar, a lot of stuff on many, many movies. It's probably one of the now considered one of the big five visual effects firms. So you have So it's one of the largest effects firms in the world, and it's based in New Zealand. Now, all of this film work has, you know, came, not all of it, but most of the film work came because of Peter Jackson. So other people also found it pretty affronting that the union would use one of his movies, given he built the entire industry, that would use one of his movies as the fulcrum to try to force this down the path. So that also created some issues. So that's kind of the background. Tim, do you think that they went the right direction? Do you think that they this codification made sense?
I voted today. Did I tell you that?
Did you vote?
I did vote today. You know, this always like it stirs up emotions in me on both levels and really gets me thinking. Are they going to shoot with the Epic camera? That's what I really want to know.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, it would be awesome to have that movie on Epic. You know, I agree with you. What happened in Pittsburgh, there's a huge opportunity for that to happen here. And right now they have a competitive advantage in the fact that they have Peter Jackson there. Right. And they've built this incredible studio and this infrastructure for handling these films. I see good things that happen with unions, and I see bad things that happen with unions. And I think that this particular case would be really, really good for the unions in Australia.
Right, and not necessarily good for the workers in New Zealand.
Yeah.
Yeah, and now the question is does this have any larger blowback for the unions? Dane, do you think that this has any effect? I mean, when we see countries making this kind of decision to push this back, and as we see more and more productions leaving California and then leaving the United States, does this put more and more pressure on the unions here because of such a stunning failure in New Zealand?
I don't think so. I want to quote a line from this article from the parliament, guy in parliament. That's just redneck pinky commo stuff, which is my favorite line from that.
I don't know you could be redneck in New Zealand.
It may have a different meaning there.
You know, because it's really, you know, that's really, you know, that those are my people. You know, those are my people. And
I think redneck there may mean communist, I think. I think, in my opinion, once you take these productions offshore to other countries or other places in the United States, and over time a groundswell of industry gets built up because you go to these other locations, you still want all the high-quality work, and then you have to bring in specialists. You may have people that move there, and then suddenly they get unions or it becomes an industry and people are all surprised that there's, you know, people are demanding certain rules, regulations and costs. So I think it's just a worldwide competitive industry, and that wherever the production goes, costs are eventually going to follow. I saw that now New Zealand has a $2.1 billion yearly film industry, and New Zealand dollars, $350 million came of the Lord of the Rings, which I think is about $280 million U.S. So this has a big impact. You figure a third of that from The Hobbit.
Well, and I think that the other thing you have to get is that, I mean, I think the other thing people have to look at is that you have to get to some point. There's two things going on. One is you can't give up those competitive advantages until you truly have something else to offer. And secondly is that you do have to find something else to offer. You know, for instance, if you go to an Industrial Light and Magic to shoot, have a visual effects done, you're not bargain hunting. You know, you're not going to ILM because they're going to be the cheapest solution for you to get your visual effects done. You go there because they are going to produce the best effects, and they're going to do them on time, and they're going to do them for the price that they told you. Now, that price may be pretty high, but it's going to be exactly what they, you know, unless you do anything rash, it will be the price that they told you, and it's very well managed, and it all gets done, and that's what people can count on, and so that's a different level of, you know, service. And that's something that we, you know, learned. I mean, my company started off doing a lot of production, and our chief advantage is that we were inexpensive. Mm-hmm. It's becoming less and less that we're inexpensive, and more that we just do a certain kind of work, you know, a certain quality of work that it's hard to compete with.
These are industries that have very, very high standards of perfection, and you take that production elsewhere, you're going to have to bring the skilled or build the skilled labors, and prices follow in whatever fashion, whether they're unions or in some other way.
So it's just a matter of finding that walking that fine line. Also in the news, NHL has they are going after the digital hockey fans. So this is according to the Wall Street Journal, their latest attempt to attract more fans and hopefully more TV viewers through its digital media strategy. The National Hockey League is introducing new mobile applications for streaming live hockey content to phones and tablet devices like the iPad. So with Verizon Wireless and Bell Mobility, you're going to be able to. There's three different versions. There's a free version that you can get that just gives you player stats and game photos. There's a next level, which is $19.99 for the season. It includes video highlights and live radio. And finally, there's a premium version that is $79 for the season, and it includes live video broadcast. Now, if you want to go, the web version has a $19.95 already. That has approximately 1,000 of the 1,200 games. So they're already kind of doing some of the streaming. This is a whole new level of that. Tim, are you planning to watch more hockey on your iPhone?
I'm waiting for it on my iPad. I want to watch it on my iPad while I'm sitting at a Kings game. There's definitely something that is really cool about being in the hockey arena and feeling the chill in the air. So maybe I'll go to a walk-in cooler or something with my iPad and watch it there, get that feeling. I'm excited about this. Not only I enjoy hockey. I'm not a huge hockey fan, but I like watching it. And to be able to watch it anywhere is pretty cool. I'm excited to see them do this. They seem to be groundbreakers in the digital space, and I'm hoping that other people follow suit, not only from an entertainment standpoint, but from a business standpoint as well, because of what we do. The more live video that's out there that needs dynamic ads and geo-targeted interactive overlays, I'm excited. So this is a really cool opportunity for us. It's a great opportunity for fans. What's happening in the cable world right now is a lot of cable companies are kind of reluctant to put their content out there because they're worried about their deals with the MSOs, and they're worried about offending those licensing deals. Whereas hockey here is like, look, we're going to make it available to anybody that wants it when they want it, and they're going to pay for it. And I applaud them for doing that.
I know. For me, I as someone who doesn't live near my town that has football, I don't really watch hockey that much. But for football, and my issue is that I can't watch all the games. I mean, the last 2 weeks I've been excited to be able to see the Steelers on in San Francisco or in Petaluma, but usually I can't. And I would love to stream something, and I don't want to buy game day or whatever that stupid thing is, because a lot of times I'm in some other part of the world, and I really want to be able to watch it on my iPad. And I would pay for that. And I think that is the thing, is that this, when we talk about paywalls, when we talk about stuff, this is the kind of content that I would pay for, so that every week I could pop up on my iPad wherever I am in the world and watch watch my favorite team do their thing. Dane, do you think that is this the beginning? Are all the sports going to do this?
Well, speaking to you, Alex, from the home of the World Championship San Francisco Giants, I can tell you that there's a lot of parents with little kids that have been taking their MLB apps with them to soccer games and things like that to watch their Giants, that has been a success.
Right.
You know what, guys? I learned a new phrase this last week. That is referred to as pass-back entertainment. Pass-back entertainment is when you're in the car and you get the iPhone or the iPad and you pass it to the back seat and you go, here, watch this and shut up.
Well, I do a lot of that.
That term is being used at all these conferences. I guess it's pass-back entertainment, new buzz phrase. Write it down. Share it with your friends. You'll be popular in the office.
Oh, my gosh. That's great. That's the nugget for today.
But I did want to point out that a couple things. One, that the MLB app and Major League Baseball has been, you know, going toward this audience with the Roku for some time, and now with the iPad, et cetera. But one thing I noticed with this huge surge in popularity of the Giants during the playoffs is that as you go to from sports bar to sports bar, or you did, they were so packed that that people were standing outside watching. And I have to think that some people have just killed their cable bill, and the only thing that they want is sports that they're not getting, so they're going to sports bars if they don't have apps.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we have another story that's kind of coming up related to that. And I, you know, the thing that I find is that when I go to a sports bar, so there is I know I keep on referring back to the Steelers, but there's a Steeler bar in Giordano Brothers in right on Columbus in San Francisco, and that place is jammed. I mean, it is, if you don't get there 45 minutes before the game, you don't have a chance for a seat. I don't think you have a chance to get in. And the place is just totally slammed. It's like going to Pittsburgh. They serve Permani sandwiches, or Permani style sandwiches, which are a very unique sandwich. They have fries and coleslaw and meat in them. And so it's kind of like Pittsburgh version of the burrito. And, Anyway, the thing is that people aren't, I don't think people are going a lot of times to these bars. I think that there is something that they're missing, and I think this is something we often miss when we talk about all this media, is that they are going for that social experience. They are going to be around a whole bunch of other people who are enjoying the game with them, where they can get a little bit more excited. They look a lot less silly jumping up and down by themselves, you know, in their living room. And I think that in a world where we have become very isolated, a lot of times with our content, I think a lot of people are oftentimes looking, you know, for that. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Sure.
Yeah. So I think finding that,
that's like the movie theater thing too. You know, you want that shared experience. You want to go out, hang out with friends. If you can't go to the ballpark, well, you go to the sports bar,
Or the concert. I mean, concerts have continued to charge enormous prices, whereas you can get the music for free.
Although that started to slide down a little bit. You know, concerts have had, I think they got to a point where they were charging maybe just a little too much. Mm-hmm. Speaking of concerts and folks pushing concerts, MySpace is now revamping. They are moving to focus more on, you guessed it, video. So this is according to C21media.net. News Corp-owned social networking website MySpace will relaunch with a focus on entertainment and music programming, and will host a new web series from U.S. production company Electus. And so they are moving towards, finding ways after the relaunch in U.S. and globally next month. Subscribers will be offered tailor-recommended recommendations for video content and live music performances. And so they're trying to find a way through the darkness towards the light. Tim, do you think that MySpace has a chance, or is this the last swing?
I think they do have a chance. I find that they have a lot of users. There's still a lot of people that go on MySpace. I mean, musicians are on MySpace selling their music. So I think we're going to see a lot of music videos. I think they're going to go after Vevo, which is owned by Google, YouTube, and Abu Dhabi. And somebody else, I think, is also an investor in Vevo. But MySpace has a lot of people that still use it. And I've also noticed that models who are in their late 20s, early 30s, that, you know, actress model type that's in that, they seem to have a MySpace page. And
did you say model with quotation or actual models?
Yeah, model with quotation. Women who audition for French Made TV seem to have stuff posted on MySpace for some reason. I don't know what that thing, but they are just starting to migrate over to Facebook. But I think there's a huge opportunity. The new MySpace site looks great. It's awesome. I mean, they had me in a couple months ago to show me what the site looked like. And it basically looks like Flipboard, if you're familiar with the app Flipboard, where you have these big squares and rectangles of photos. That's kind of how the navigation looks like, and it's beautiful. And they've blocked out the ways that people can uglify their MySpace page.
Thank God.
Yeah, so hopefully we're not going to see all these really nasty animated GIFs that people are using. But you never know. They might figure out a way to do it.
My canary in the coal mine, of course, with this is my daughter, you know, who was, for a long time, she was... she was in using MySpace and with a little bit of Facebook. And now, you know, I talked to her. The last time I was talking to her about it, she said that she's moved from MySpace to, she's pretty much just uses Facebook. She doesn't really use MySpace anymore. And she still doesn't get Twitter. You know, so she doesn't really understand why you want to do that. So, which is a generational thing. And, but when I saw her moving from, she looked at Facebook as a way to interact with me and other adults. And now all of her friends have moved to Facebook. So that's when I look at it going, oh, I don't know if it can make it. Dane, do you think that MySpace has a chance?
Well, not with original programming, I don't. But if they move towards the, you know, an alternative to YouTube, I think that is really their competitor, not Facebook. I think they've lost to Facebook. But if they can move in the direction of YouTube, I think they've got a really good chance.
Really? You think they can compete with YouTube?
I do.
And not Facebook?
Yeah, I think that I mean, if you think about it, what's really big on YouTube is stuff like Lady Gaga with a billion views. MySpace is those people that are on there are very keen towards videos and they really dropped the ball on that several years ago. That's right. Really the only thing that I see that they could go.
Okay, well we'll see how that goes. And this might be the generation that does it. This is according to DSL reports this is an issue where a lot of people have been talking about cord cutters being a group of people who are, they're trying to cut costs, they're unemployed, they're trying to find a way to make that work. But it turns out, according to a lot of their studies, 54% of likely cord cutters are under 40. 97% have graduated high school, and 69% have or are pursuing higher degree. 91% are employed, full-time students or retired. And 57% make more than $50,000 a year. So this has really not been what the cable industry, and other people have been talking about, or even some of us have been like talking about the fact that people are just trying to save money. It seems to be less about saving money and more about making a choice that this is not something that they want anymore, and moving that money to another direction. Dane, should this be a real a scary set of statistics for the industry?
I think that if I'm getting this story correct, I think that the idea is that people are moving towards Apple TV and Google TV and that type of thing. Am I correct here?
Yeah, I think so.
We talked about sports, and I think sports are still one of the reasons that people are staying with cable. But there's one other thing that we haven't talked about, and that's porn. You can still get your porn on cable, but I don't think it's quite as easy to get it. I think that's one of the other reasons people are sticking to cable. I had an interesting conversation with a friend of mine who does IT for a major hotel, and they're talking about moving to Google TV, but they have a profit center as well that is different. And I'm very interested to see how Google TV and Apple TV will interact with more of this illicit content.
Yeah, in addition to just being kind of grossed out by it, the one thing I have to say about porn in general is that, man, watching it at a hotel just seems to be insane. I mean, from a trackability perspective, it just seems like I don't get it. Like, I just don't, I always see that go by and I go, boy, because I'm in a lot of hotels and I see that go by as you're going through the thing and they have those little ads and I'm like, that would be insane. Anyway.
Since this is just an interesting sidetrack, this guy I once did deal with those boxes years ago in another job, and I asked him, hey, what is the average length of – and he said 17 minutes.
Oh, boy. Now, Tim, do you think that these cord cutters, do they pose a real problem, or is this just another kind of blip on the radar?
Well, you know, the thinking before was that these were unemployed people. Well, you have to have a cord first before you cut it. So if you're unemployed, you don't have cable to begin with. I think back to my college days. I didn't have cable. You were never home. Why do you need cable? If you want to go see a sports game, you go to a sports bar where there might be girls. I mean, well, why would you want to have cable at home when you're in your 20s? there is a big you know, need here, and for parents, the programming needs are being filled elsewhere. They're able to have that pass back entertainment, and they're able to, the kids are able to see what they want on Netflix. So I think we're going to see more of it, especially in the homes where people don't care about sports. It's just crazy. I mean, I have cable, and my bill for cable, phone, and internet, and I have high speed, but I have the lowest high speed. My bill was $165, and I don't have any premium movie channels.
Yeah, I know that my bill, I keep on looking at the TV portion of it and wondering whether I really need this anymore. My wife watches it a lot, I think much more than I do. But I think
just get rid of Oprah.
It's just Oprah, and for me, you know, Alton Brown, although they've been playing a lot of repeats on Alton Brown. Like, I already have those ones, and so I'm just kind of like,
You know. You're not going to see any, I don't think you're going to see long form Food Network stuff online anytime soon. They're pulling it all. I was talking to the guys over at Food Network, and they're just hiding everything, all their long form, all their video.
Well, you know,
it used to be front and center.
Well, just because they don't want to affect their subscribers.
Yeah, you know, they're making too much money in the cable world.
I mean, the process of getting these shows off of Food Network is quite a thing. I mean, what you do is you TiVo them, or I don't TiVo them. I don't have TiVo. I just use the Comcast, whatever, and I save them all. Like, I just hit save, and then it gathers them all up. And then while I'm doing something else, I hit play, but I have it running through an iTV, and then I just digitize them all to my iPad. But it takes, you know, it's just like,
it's a lot of work.
It's such a process. It's not really that much work. Because you just play them one after the other, and you get a long video, and then you snip them up. It doesn't, you know, because they're just playing in the background. It's not like I'm doing anything.
You're a Food Network watcher, or your wife is?
I don't watch the Food Network. I just watch Alton Brown. Alton Brown, as far as I'm concerned, could have his own network, and that's all I'd watch. I don't really need the rest of the Food Network. I think it's kind of silly. So, I don't watch Alton Brown, I have to say. So a lot of people think that I do cook a lot. I cook more and more now. Mm. I'm over the weekends, not during the week, but over the weekends, I cook most of the food. And a mixture, mostly barbecue, and then a little bit of, I make breakfast and barbecue. That's pretty much all I do. But all of it's like Alton Brown stuff. So anything I'm making new, Carlita knows that I just saw some Alton Brown show and I want to try it. And you, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But she's very excited that I've decided to learn how to make my own tortillas. So, because they actually turned out. So, now moving on to the next thing here: how to build an audience for niche video. This is actually from Daisy Whitney. Remember Daisy Whitney?
Yes.
Moment. Anyway, so
she's got a book coming out.
The book is out, isn't it?
It's out. I believe it's out. I have to go look and tweet about it, but I'm excited. I'm going to buy it.
Yeah, Daisy Whitney, our illustrious co-host. She has her book, I believe, is out today or this week. Oh. And so it's called The Mockingbirds, and it is you want to check that out. Check out the New Media Minute. She's going to talk about it a little bit, but you can definitely find it now. So it's available. It's called The Mockingbirds by Daisy Whitney, and you should definitely check that out. And one of the things that she was talking about, she said she recently caught up with producer and host of the popular web series Vendor TV on Next New Networks. And, you know, the show is attracting an audience of 200,000. And they asked the creator about how to build that audience, hone a niche, and build real value. And he said, follow your passion. A better way at looking at web videos is that it's your business card. Don't think that supporting yourself is going to happen 7 hours after you create the show. If your mom and one other person watches it, you're doing well. And, you know, I have to admit, that's how we've approached all of these shows. You know, This Week in Media, for instance, is just for my mom. You know, the only one that I worry about, I call her and she says, well, you know, when you were talking about YouTube, I just don't know. I don't know if I really agree with that. I mean, I really like to watch, you know, some more deep tracks, you know. Tim, has that been the case for you as you start to build?
You know, building an audience is, it really depends on finding that neighborhood where your audience is going to be and appealing to them. You know, you look at iTunes. iTunes was great for me. That was a great place for me to build an audience. And then I was able to migrate that audience over to YouTube as well. You look at Next New Networks, that works great for some people. For other people, it doesn't. You know, like Epic Foo, They tried Next New Networks. They tried Revision 3. They weren't able to build an audience there. So it right. really depends on finding where your audience is and where you can hang out.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, I know I was just in a conversation with someone last week about it, and they asked how I look at where the markets are when we make shows. I'm like, I don't look at where the markets are when we make shows. I just go, I've decided that I want to make a show, and I'll make it until I get tired of it. And obviously, I haven't gotten tired of This Week in Media or Mac Break or some of the other shows, or until I can't figure it out anymore. You know, we just make the shows. I don't think we're as nearly as scientific as some others. Dane, you're actually starting some shows right now, aren't you?
Yeah, I do my own little show, Hey, with Dane Golden, where I interview interesting people. But it's not a niche. It's very broad-based, just because I enjoy interviewing fascinating people.
Evidently, I'm not very fascinating, because Dane hasn't interviewed me yet.
When would you like to come on? No. We'll talk.
No, I'm just kidding. Anyway, so, but that, and that's just really something that's more of something you're interested in, right? I mean, that's, you're really following your passion of wanting to you know, talk to people.
That's exactly right, broad-based. But I think that, you know, what people are really asking when they say how to build an audience for niche web, they're saying, how do I make money by doing whatever I'm doing with a web series? And I think that that is a math that not a lot of people have solved. I think when you have something that is niche like tech with the Twit Network or and you have celebrities like Leo Laporte or Tom Merritt, I think then you can really bump up big numbers. But I don't think that the math has been solved on that in most areas.
I agree. I think that we've done a bunch of shows for other people that have been much more general audience. I mean, we had some ones that we had a lot of fun with. I think Cocktails on the Fly is a good example of a show that, man, it was just a lot of fun, a lot of fun to make, and a lot of great content. But as a general market content, you know, making how to make mixed drinks, it was a little bit more of an uphill battle to find that niche audience than it was for technology, especially at the time we were doing them. I think those are still available. I think you can find them online if you do Cocktails on the Fly, and you'll see our little experiments years ago. But I think that that was definitely my concern when we first were talking to folks there, was that we weren't sure. You know, I was like, I was very excited about doing some different things, and I wanted to experiment with it. But I was like, the only area I know how to build a niche market in is tech. You know, just because that's the market where most people are using those using their appliances. But I think that now we're moving to a much wider audience. Tim, do you think that this is this wider audience is going to really make these niches more available for things other than just technology?
Yeah, absolutely. You look at all the blogger moms that are out there and what they're doing in this marketplace. It's a huge opportunity for this niche programming. The tough part is monetizing it. And how are you going to build a big enough audience, even if it's a niche, that it's valuable to an advertiser or a sponsor, or it's valuable enough that people are going to pay for it? And those are things to consider when you're trying to, you know, go out there and start it. But there's a huge opportunity for this.
And I think Tim just had a visitor. And with that, we're going to move on to the next story here. We have HTML5 video is winning over the web. So this is according to CNET. And this is, of course, we've been seeing this slowly roll out. So first, Apple didn't support Flash on the iPhone. Then they didn't support Flash on the iPad. Now they're not installing it on the new machines. You have to download it yourself. And all of this is adding more and more pressure. And now we're even seeing Adobe producing tools that not only output Flash, but also HTML5. So the real question is that now there's still some things that aren't, you know, Flash network. Most of the Hulu stuff, a lot of cable content, MySpace, Metacafe, 5-minute videos, Ustream and Justin TV, international sites. A lot of these are still Flash-based, but it seems like this kind of glacial move is going towards HTML5. Dane, do you think this is the trajectory? Do you think there's any way to change it at this point?
I don't think it's glacial at all. When you're building a site, or if you're providing video or content of any sort, you check all the platforms. And if you haven't checked your video on an iPad, you have not done your due diligence as a content creator. Right. And if you find like me, where you have an embed of a Ustream feed right on your homepage, and then you go to the iPad and realize you're not one of the people who's been upgraded to HTML5, it's maddening. It just destroys your whole vision of what you're creating, because the whole concept of being on the web is that it, whatever the platform, you're available. That's the whole reason. So
some videos are going to HTML5, and then some of them are only on Flash. Is that how that's working?
With Ustream, they have moved some providers to HTML5, but not all. I think it's a gradual rollout it's taken months. I don't know how you get on. I haven't gone about requesting to change yet, but I'm planning on it.
Right.
Essentially, if you can't view your video or website on the iPad, you're not doing your job as a website designer. So that is a big problem. And that's where people are taking their media. So if it's not on the iPad, if it doesn't work on the iPad, it doesn't work.
And Tim, what is your, from your perspective, the stuff that you guys are working on, do you see this this move? Is the move really going to HTML5? I mean, do you think that there's really a future in Flash? I mean, is it something that's going to be able to coexist, or do you see it all just kind of moving away from that platform?
Well, it's going to be interesting to see how Adobe responds to the iPad and how they deal with it, because the reason that Flash isn't on the iPad is because it's too heavy. It requires a plug-in, and it makes it hard for a smaller gadget to process everything, because it just eats up so much processing power. Whereas with HTML5, and especially with HTML5 video that is adaptive bitrate streaming, and for those of you who are listeners that don't know what that is with adaptive bitrate streaming, you have a video. That video gets processed into different versions. You have an audio-only version. You have a low version, a medium version, a medium-high version, and a high-high version. And then all of those versions get chopped up into 10-second clips. And so those are immediately accessible depending on your connection speed. So rather than waiting for something to buffer, you get a lower quality version. If you have a bad connection, your app quits, you get nothing. If you have a really low connection and you're watching a Major League Baseball game, you get audio only. So you can still hear the baseball.
Well, and the other thing is that it's all happening dynamically. So you go from a 3G connection to a Wi-Fi connection while you're watching it. And it will, go from being rough to clear, right?
Absolutely. You get a much better picture on a Wi-Fi than you do on 3G. Because remember, 3G is kind of like being an underage drinker in New Orleans. you have lots of bars, but no service.
That is awesome. Do you think that this kind of thing, so you can't do that on Flash, right? So the dynamic right now is a dynamic streaming something that is not available on a Flash streamer?
Yeah, to my knowledge, it's not. Now, Kaltura has created a plugin that will work with Flash, and whether or not that's going to work easy on Flash, I don't know yet. Haven't seen it, haven't checked it out, haven't tested it. But I do know that HTML5 plays great on an iPad, and Flash does not. I know that adaptive bitrate streaming works great on an iPad, and Flash does not. So,
well, I think that's one of the real challenges here is that right now, someone else has to. I think I saw our report go by this morning that 94% of all, first of all, 94% of the tablets out there being sold are iPads, and that the demand for netbooks has dropped by 80% because of the iPad. And so you're having this massive. One of the most popular products in electronics history rolling through and not supporting a platform. That's got to be something that has got to have Adobe thinking. And, of course, what we saw this week is Adobe is now building tools that will let you export to HTML5. It seems like they're obviously reacting. The real question is there any long-term future for Flash on mobile devices?
It's going to be tough.
Yeah, Dane, what were you going to say?
Well, I wanted to include that people are not just using the iPad just as a media-consuming device. There are a lot of managers all over the Silicon Valley now that are using the iPad as their primary device. They're using it in presentations.
Yeah.
It's sort of driving IT folks nuts because they don't really want to support it, but they can't stop it.
Well, and I think that this is the issue. I mean, I think that the issue right now is that the iPad has become – there's something about the form factor and, of course, the fact that it's so easy to kind of get running is that we're seeing this just – it's not just like in Hollywood they're talking about. Everyone's doing their pitches with iPads and actors are looking at their scripts with iPads. And everyone's – you know, everyone is using these tablet devices to, you know, make all of this stuff work. And you're seeing this in industry where people are using those on work sites to look at view blueprints. You're looking at, you know, schools using them as their primary pieces. And so it's not just that they're being used as I just want to watch movies. They really are this utility and that just happens to have the right form factor. And that seems to be something that I think more ubiquitous. It's had a bigger impact, in my opinion, than the iPhone. So it's a very interesting thing. I know that my son, I can tell you right now, likes the iPad a lot better than the iPhone. I give him the iPhone. He kind of looks at me like, what do I look like? Chop meat? he's like, I want the iPad. You know, so the...
give me the big one.
Yeah, I want that. He really just asked for iPad. You know, and almost from the time he wakes up, and I have to... he doesn't get it until the evening. He just... during the day...
Is he 17 or 18?
Yeah, 3. So almost 3. And as he's 17 or 18. Anyway, final story here. Of course, some of us saw a lot of the Rally to Restore Sanity on Saturday. This is Jon Stewart's little soiree in the mall, and so they took him there, and it turned out that this turned out to be a big media bash event. So this wasn't... it was less about politics, which I think he couldn't really dive into without changing the tone of his show. I mean, changing how people look at his show. But it really attacked TV, the media, what they focus on, how they focus on it, and so on and so forth. And it really... and he's been on this, you know, this bandwagon for quite some time. Dane, do you think that the skewers stuck?
Well, they stuck with a certain group of people. There's... more and more, our media has diverged into people you listen to, people you follow, and people you don't. So I don't really think it changed a lot of people's minds. I think it just got people excited that already believed one thing.
Mm-hmm. Tim, what do you think?
Well, I think it's interesting because whenever you say what you believe, you alienate people that don't believe that same thing. And that's what we're seeing happen in the media. That's what we're seeing happen in on Jon Stewart's show. You look at this event, they didn't have any super big stars come there because as a Hollywood celebrity, you have to be careful about what you say politically because you can lose at the box office or you can lose on the ratings because right. You make your political views known and alienate half your audience. And unfortunately, that's the microscope that you... and it's a shame that we don't... when you're trying to do things, you don't really have freedom of speech. You look at the Dixie Chicks and what happened to them. That happens all the time, you know. I mean, when I'm on this show, I have to tone down my rhetoric about how much I love Apple because I know that... well, I guess I haven't done that yet, but
well, yeah, I know that I alienate when I see how many people quit my Twitter account. I find that my Twitters alienate almost as many people as people who follow me. You know, like the new followers and the quitters are almost even. So I just slowly get bigger. I know I have taken a pretty hard line about not worrying too much about it. But even then, I still, every time I post something, I do have to keep in my head, there's like nearly 20,000 people that are about to get this. You know, and so I just, you know, it does affect, you know, like I won't respond. So some people, if I don't respond to your direct messages, but replies to me, usually what it means is that I'm thinking about how many people are going to read a personal conversation about whether we should go have lunch or whether we should do something or certain ideas that people have that I do want to talk about. But I just don't necessarily want to talk about it in an audience of 20 grand. So, but I think I do find that, and I have a very small audience. I mean, a very small Twitter audience. And I notice that affects me as far as what I post, you know, and I can't even imagine having big audiences of Twitter followers of, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of people. It would just be an entirely different set of pressure. And if you're on in the media. So it's very interesting. And we have run this one all the way into the ground. Tim, where can people find you?
You can find me at onetimstreet.com or check out mdialogue.com.
Dane, where can people find you?
Just Google Hey on Google and you'll find me, or hey.com, at Dane Golden on Twitter.
This mess that you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out. This Week in Media is a PixelCore.tv production produced by Suzanne Llewellyn, with technical producers John Riley and Alutha Jaminkar. Content contributor is Jason Perrier.